All right. The Waterbury stepmom is making a court appearance today. Attorney Norm Pattis on the show. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, morning.
What should we expect?
I think there'll be a lot said, or at least in chambers, probably on the record, about extrajudicial or public comments. I mean, the young man's decision to, through a spokesman, make a statement about himself will probably have the state more upset than the defense, and the defense is hopping mad. But there's nothing the state can do about it. You know, he is not a party to the action. He's a witness, and the court really doesn't have jurisdiction to gag this young man.
Oh, why would the state be upset about that?
Because the state has a duty to assure that the defendant gets a fair trial. And whenever this young man making statements unchallenged in a courtroom, who is an enormously sympathetic figure, is going to stir the pot, and it's going to make it harder for the defendant to get a fair trial. And well, that's what the state wants. The state wants to hear from the young man, but they want to hear from him on the witness stand. Now, if he, meaning the young man, takes to the airwaves, it's only a matter of time until she does. And, you know, I don't know this, but I recall a case where we prepped a witness to go on 48 hours to tell their side of the story. And it wouldn't surprise me whether she's been contacted by one of the major news networks and that we see her on 48 hours or Dateline or something sooner or later.
I think, Norm, you're right if she was solid. But I look at her, and I don't mean to pass judgment, but I will. I don't think she would hold up in that kind of an arena.
Yeah,
right.
You know, it's hard to say. You never know how a person will do. And even if she didn't hold up, that would be as sympathetic interview as she's going to get. It's certainly more, you know, it's easy to tell your story when nobody's challenging the details, which is what happens on the witness stand. So, you know, if the young man continues to make statements, he's inviting the defense to make statements in response. And this case ends up getting tried in the press rather than a courtroom, and it's harder to get a fair trial. So
you sound annoyed that the victim released. You sound annoyed that the victim released a statement.
It's not so much the victim. He's a victim. You know, he's caught in the middle of circumstances he scarcely understands. It strikes me that there's undoubtedly a personal injury law firm involved. And I recall in some cases, I recall in the Sandy Hook case, if I spoke to a reporter in the hallway, a public relations firm's representative immediately went up to the reporter and wanted to be debriefed on what I said so that they could rebut anything I said. And don't be seduced for a moment that this case isn't high stakes. An enterprising law firm for the plaintiff, for the young man, could make a case that somehow the state failed him. And although the various immunity doctrines that attach to this state would be difficult to penetrate, they might not be impossible in a sympathetic case. And so I think there's going to be a real effort to position this case for a civil suit. And it wouldn't surprise me if a PI firm is involved in bankrolling this at this point.
What did you think of the stepmom's attorney's response to the statement the victim made?
You know, he's doing the best he can. It's a hard case to be in. I think people are tired of hearing from him. If she's going to speak, they want to hear from the young man. Or if the young man's going to speak, rather, I think they want to hear from her. And I think he's got a strategic decision to make. Does he put her on one of the the national news shows and see what happens? Because she's going to have to testify at trial almost certainly. She's got some splaining to do, as we say in the trade. Let's air it out and see how she does.
Do you think by
that
now
would be my recommendation?
Do you think by now he's had either himself or a couple of other attorneys in a room with her asking her questions just to see if her story holds together?
Yeah,
and he may have already made a determination that she is not going to be a great witness.
You know, I don't know Attorney Kloides. I know of him, and, you know, I can say hello to him in the hall. I don't know how much of a risk taker he is, but undoubtedly he knows what she's going to say. And you begin to see the outlines of a defense in the case in his statement. You know, there's more to this story than meets the eye. And I suspect when the case unfolds, it'll be something along the following lines. They had trouble with him. They engaged in inappropriate discipline. They got scared. The father insisted, or she insisted, that they take him out of school. One thing led to another. When the father died, she panicked, and it's going to be some version of the Stockholm defense.
If she does go public on like a Dateline or 48 hours, I mean, there's restrictions the lawyers would give as to what they can say, aren't there?
Yes. Well, restrictions. So the law, the rules of professional conduct prohibit a party or a lawyer in particular, I should say, withdraw the party part, from making extrajudicial comments that mm-hmm. might prejudice a panel. Right. However, if the state or a victim makes a statement, you can rebut it. And so that would be his first line of defense in what he said. Second, it's not clear that the rules regarding extrajudicial comments apply to a defendant in a criminal case. As paradoxical as it sounds, the Sixth Amendment guarantees a fair trial to the defendant. It doesn't say anything about the state getting a fair trial. And I realize how crazy that sounds because they're both parties in the case, but the Sixth Amendment is an individual right and it belongs to defendants. So the court would have to rely on its inherent supervisory authority to try to silence her. And we had that issue in front of the state Supreme Court in the Fotis Doulos case. Mr. Doulos committed suicide before the court ruled. So we don't know what the answer would be as a matter of Connecticut law. So it's a ripe issue out there that, you know, from my perspective, issues are worth exploring. That's why they're issues.
You know, when the attorney for the stepmom made a statement in reaction to the statement that the victim released, and he did it through a PR person, I thought it was a real bad move because he made the victim, he almost mocked him and called him a liar.
Yeah.
And I just thought, if you're working a jury pool right now, it's not a good look.
Right.
I don't think it's a good look.
Well, I think I don't think it either. I mean, I read that statement, and I think he did call the kid a liar.
He did.
And that's defamatory per se. So, you know, he's now facing the potential for a civil suit for defamation, and I would not want to be on the receiving end of one of those, you know?
Yeah, I didn't.
It's a really tricky line to walk. And, you know, you don't get that training for that in law school. You get battle tested on that, and everybody makes mistakes. God knows I've made a boatload.
No, if I'm her and I see what's happening now, I'm thinking maybe I should switch horses.
Right.
You know, I don't, you know, who knows? I don't know. I've never spoken to her. You know, we have a minor piece in her case involving the appeal of the ankle monitor in front of the appellate court. They've yet to rule. So, you know, the choice of counsel is idiosyncratic. I mean, plenty of people would probably pull my wife aside and say, you could have done better than that jerk. But there's no accounting for taste, and people choose the lawyers that they're comfortable with and remain with them for reasons that are all their own. It's like a wedding. You're in it for sickness and in health, and you know you've got to trust the person and their moves. There are things I might have done differently. Who knows? There are things I might not have done as well. I don't know what I don't know. But as to the question, you know, has he sat down with her to try to put together a defense? I guarantee they're working on that. And today there'll likely be a discussion in chambers about all the psychiatric records that he's entitled to, the defense that is, as a result of the posture of the case, and that'll take some months to sort out.
So today we're going to hear what they're going to talk about, you know, no comment in public, right? Gag orders and what else?
I don't know that those will make the record. It depends on the lawyers. They're certainly going to discuss it in chambers.
So the real stuff we're not going to know about. The good stuff that happens today.
Yeah.
The stuff we're actually interested in, we're not going to hear about today. That'll happen
in
chambers.
You might not. And that's one of the ironies of the Connecticut criminal procedure on the state level. Although the public and the press has a First Amendment right to be present in court, the critical stages of the proceeding, the real work gets done before everybody gets on the record. Mm-hmm. And I think that's unfortunate. No news organization has yet to challenge that, and I don't know why.
Do you think her attorney seen all the evidence yet?
No, I don't think the state has either. I think that there was a little bit of time that passed between the fire and the arrest. I think, you told me, 5 weeks or something like that, or six perhaps? They did enough to develop probable cause, and I'm sure that witnesses are still coming forward to this day who may have seen something, heard something. You know, it is not at all uncommon in Connecticut, especially in a case of some significance, to have evidence surface even during trial to be getting discovery. So I think that, you know, they're working on it. I think the young man, I don't know anything about him other than what I read in the papers. Clearly,
horribly sad.
It's very, very sad.
Yeah, clearly a horrific circumstance. Yeah. I don't know if he's capable of testifying. I've predicted here before that there'll be what are called Yarsbeck hearings on his testimonial capabilities. And, you know, there's a lot of work.
The interviews that he had with the police? Is that something that the prosecution can give to the jury view, have the jury view instead of putting him on the stand?
No, almost certainly not, because under the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause, you have a right to confront, that is to cross-examine witnesses against you. Now, and it's a very difficult line to hew. Now, it may be that they get to put on some statements to physicians because that's an exception to the hearsay rule, because it's a statement to a treating physician. But then you've still got the confrontation problem. So there are significant issues about this.
He's the key to all this.
Right.
He is.
If you're the prosecution, you're like, we got to get him on the stand.
And I think they will. And I think it's going to be a matter of some time before they make a decision about how and when. Now, in terms of speedy trial requirements, both state and federal constitutions guarantee a person accused a quote unquote speedy trial. If in Connecticut, what that means is if you're out on bond, as she is, you're not eligible for a trial until 1 year after the arrest. And so I don't recall the date of the arrest, but we're still some time from that date.
Right.
So lots to think about.
That's a minefield for the stepmom's attorney if this kid gets up on the stand and gives a very compelling case. And you know that your cross-examination is going to determine whether or not your client goes to jail or not. So you have to kind of pull the pins on what this kid said, but you have to do it in such a way that the jury doesn't turn on you. You've been in
that's
a situation.
That's an interesting metaphor.
Before, right?
Pulling the pin, having stepped on any number of hand grenades in court, you're exactly right. I mean, it's hard to attack without being cruel. And if you're perceived as cruel, you lose some ground with the jury. And, it's hard to fight with class for a person's life,
Yesterday, we had the victim of a serial killer.
I listened to that interview.
She's the only victim to survive the Connecticut River Valley serial killer.
Wow. What year was that serial killer around?
I think 88.
Okay. Yeah.
She was stabbed 27 times.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
She was pregnant, stabbed 27 times. She survived, the baby survived.
And now there's a
granddaughter.
Yeah. It's an amazing story.
And you heard that, and what did you think?
I'm just too much of a lawyer for my own good. I listened and I'm like, wow, that's incredible. And then I heard her say later that her case was still open. And I'm thinking, well, the guy either did it to you or not. If it's still open, is it solved? And what's going on there?
They never found
it. So I didn't forgive myself that impulse to always be searching the record for things to use. But there it was. But, I recall years ago is, dark humor. That's how lawyers survive this trade. Years ago, I represented a man who was accused of being a serial killer, and they were able to make one case against him, and there were 9 or 10 bodies that went unaddressed. He had issues, and so during trial, I kept moving for competency examinations. Judge, my client can't assist in his own defense. He's out there, motion denied. So, after, I don't know, 6-8 weeks of trial, there's a knock on the jury door. I go back into the lockup, and the man says, Mr. Pettis, I think I finally figured out who the real killer is. And I said, Mr. So-and-so, I think the jury has some thoughts they'd like to share with you on that topic.
What a coincidence.
And when the jury said guilty, the room cheered and the judge banged his gavel. Order. It brought back dark memories.
Attorney Norm Pettis, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Be well.
All right. Thank you.